Just miles off the coast of Venezuela, the twin island nation of Trinidad and Tobago finds itself walking a delicate line between diplomacy and defense, between compassion and control. For decades, the waters that separate them have felt narrow, but the political and humanitarian rift has never been wider. What began as a regional neighborly relationship has morphed into a complex crisis defined by mass migration, illegal crossings, energy diplomacy, and accusations of human rights violations. As Venezuela crumbles under internal collapse, tens of thousands flee across the Gulf of Paria seeking refuge in Trinidad and Tobago. But the island nation, already struggling with limited resources and political pressure, faces impossible choices: protect its borders or extend a hand, follow international protocols or act in national interest. This is not just a story of nations. It is a human story of fear, politics, oil, and survival. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Waters Between Us: A History of Connection and Collapse. The Gulf of Paria is only about 7 miles wide at its narrowest point, just enough for a desperate man in a small boat to dream of escape. On one side, the northern coast of Venezuela stretches out, cloaked in political turmoil. On the other, the southern edge of Trinidad and Tobago stands as a beacon of stability, prosperity, and promise. That distance is the entire difference between hope and despair for thousands of Venezuelans. But this maritime boundary has long been more than just geography. For generations, Venezuela and Trinidad and Tobago maintained a relationship shaped by oil, culture, and migration. In the 1970s, when Venezuela was flush with oil money, Trinbagonians traveled there in droves for jobs and business. Spanish words seeped into Trini slang, and music, from soca to salsa, danced across the sea in both directions. It was a relationship of cultural exchange and mutual respect. That changed dramatically with the rise of Hugo Chavez. In the early 2000s, Chavez's socialist agenda gained support from the working poor, but exist in isolation. Their choices echo outward, and the weight of global expectation can fall heavy on even the smallest shoulders. In Chapter 5, we turn inward to explore how this prolonged crisis is reshaping the identity and politics of Trinidad and Tobago itself. Because when borders tighten and fears rise, it's not just migrants who change, it's the soul of a nation. Chapter 5. A Nation Redefined: Identity, Politics, and the Cost of Compassion. Trinidad and Tobago has always been a nation of blended cultures: African, Indian, Indigenous, Chinese, European, and Middle Eastern roots, all woven into its food, its festivals, and its faiths. But as the Venezuelan crisis deepens and waves of migration continue, the very idea of what it means to be Trinbagonian is starting to shift. Not long ago, compassion came easily. The island's churches, temples, and mosques preached unity. And for many, welcoming Venezuelan migrants felt like a moral duty. But over time, cracks began to show. Schools became overcrowded. Clinics were stretched thin. In working-class neighborhoods, unemployment bred resentment. People started asking hard questions. How many more can we take? Who gets the jobs? Who gets the beds? Who gets seen by the doctor first? The arrival of thousands of Venezuelans, many without legal status, forced a national conversation, not just about immigration, but about identity. Were these newcomers guests, refugees, illegals, brothers, threats? Political lines hardened. In parliament and on the streets, debates flared. Opposition leaders accused the ruling government of mismanaging the crisis, of failing both the migrants and the citizens. "We are a country, not a charity," one MP declared during a heated debate. We cannot sacrifice the well-being of our people to save the world. The ruling party pushed back, citing the 2019 registration program, humanitarian exceptions, and bilateral talks with Venezuela as proof of balanced leadership. But behind the talking points was a deeper fear that this issue could decide the next election. Radio talk shows buzzed with divided callers. Social media became a battlefield. Some warned of rising crime and cultural erosion. Others defended the migrants as hardworking and desperate, simply seeking survival. Nowhere was this tension more visible than in local communities. In neighborhoods like La Brea, Arima, and Chaguanas, small businesses struggled. Street corners, once dominated by doubles vendors, were now dotted with Venezuelan food stalls. Some residents welcomed the flavors, others felt displaced. In the job market, unregulated labor created friction. Many Venezuelan workers accepted lower wages, not by choice but by desperation, and employers took advantage. Trinbagonian laborers cried foul, accusing businesses of undermining wage standards and workplace safety. Even language became a flashpoint. Schools faced new challenges with Spanish-speaking students. Teachers lacked the training and resources to adapt. Some parents questioned why their children's education was being disrupted by non-citizens. But it wasn't all division. Artists, activists, and young people rose up in unexpected ways. Musicians blended Spanish lyrics with soca rhythms. Collaborative murals popped up in San Fernando and Port of Spain, featuring imagery of unity, struggle, and hope. Community centers hosted cultural exchanges, language lessons, and shared meals, small acts of resistance against the tide of fear. Still, the stress on national systems continued to mount. The healthcare system, already strained before the crisis, buckled under added pressure. Patients reported longer wait times. Medication shortages increased. Doctors and nurses burned out. The Ministry of Health issued public appeals for calm and cooperation, but on the ground, frustration simmered. Religion, often a force for unity, also became politicized. Some faith leaders preached inclusion and sanctuary. Others warned of moral decay and loss of tradition. Sermons became social commentary. Congregations took sides. Yet amid the noise, many ordinary Trinbagonians quietly chose compassion. A retired nurse in Cuba took in a Venezuelan girl orphaned at sea. A taxi driver in Siparia offered rides to migrants walking to immigration offices. A market vendor in Princestown taught a mother how to cook callaloo with local greens she'd never seen before. These stories never made headlines, but they mattered, because even as politics divided the nation, humanity continued beneath the surface. Trinidad and Tobago is being reshaped, not by politicians, not by pundits, but by people, locals and migrants alike, adapting to a new reality. A reality where identity is fluid, borders are tested, and compassion carries a cost. In Chapter 6, we'll follow the money, tracing how migration, energy deals, and international aid have altered Trinidad and Tobago's economy. Because beneath every act of politics and policy is a bottom line. And in times of crisis, survival often comes down to dollars and decisions. Chapter 6, The Economic Equation, Oil, Aid, and the Cost of Survival. The story of Trinidad and Tobago is a story written in oil, black gold that once brought prosperity, power, and global significance to a small island state. But in the shadow of Venezuela's collapse and a growing migrant crisis, the economic equation has changed. Now, that same oil, along with natural gas, foreign aid, and remittances, forms a tangled web of survival and strain. Even before the influx of Venezuelan migrants, Trinidad and Tobago was facing economic challenges. Oil production was declining. Gas fields were drying up. Petrotrin, the state oil company, was shuttered in 2018 and restructured under Heritage Petroleum, a move that sparked controversy and job losses. Global energy prices were volatile, and COVID-19 had already battered the economy. Then came the humanitarian crisis next door. At first, some saw the Venezuelan migration wave as an economic opportunity. Thousands of willing workers, many highly skilled, entered the informal labor market. Construction sites, restaurants, and farms began hiring Venezuelans for less pay and longer hours. Businesses that had slowed found a new labor pool. But this opportunity came at a cost. With so many undocumented workers, the formal job market became distorted. Local workers accused employers of replacing them with cheaper labor. Wages stagnated. Labor unions protested. The economy started to split into two tracks. One visible and regulated, the other shadowy and unaccountable. Meanwhile, foreign aid remained limited. Despite hosting thousands of migrants, Trinidad and Tobago received far less support than larger South American host countries like Colombia or Brazil. The UNHCR and International Organization for Migration offered basic assistance, but it wasn't enough to meet growing needs. And so the financial burden fell on the state and the people. Public services, already stretched thin, struggled to absorb the pressure. The Ministry of Education had to find ways to accommodate Spanish-speaking children without official school placements. The health sector saw surging demand, especially in prenatal and emergency care. The Housing Development Corporation faced new challenges from overcrowding and squatting. To navigate these growing pressures, the government turned to its most critical resource, energy. Natural gas became the lifeline, not just for exports, but for bargaining. The Dragon gas field deal with Venezuela promised economic revival. If Trinidad and Tobago could successfully extract and process Venezuelan gas, it could feed its petrochemical plants, boost exports, and generate revenue to ease social strain. But this deal, like everything connected to Venezuela, came with risk. The U.S. granted license was conditional. Payments had to go toward humanitarian use. No cash could reach the Maduro regime. The optics had to be perfect. One misstep could invite sanctions or revoke the license entirely. Yet without the gas, Trinidad and Tobago's industrial sector would suffer further. LNG exports would decline. Jobs would be lost. GDP would fall. It was a high-stakes gamble. Complicating matters, the informal economy was growing faster than ever. Venezuelan-run food stalls, hair salons, and markets began appearing in towns and cities. Some thrived, offering new flavors and affordable services. Others operated completely off the books, avoiding taxes and labor laws. This raised resentment, but also revealed the resilience of migrant entrepreneurship. Many Venezuelans were not passive recipients of aid. They were economic actors, carving out space in a foreign land through hustle and grit. Still, without legal status, they remained vulnerable, unable to access loans, licenses, or protections. Then there were remittances, money sent back to Venezuela from relatives working in Trinidad and Tobago. Small amounts added up. While the local economy strained, thousands of believers flowed from Cedros, San Juan, and Arima into cities like Maturin and Barcelona. Migrants propped up families, funded school fees, and paid for medicine in a country where the local currency had collapsed. This financial connection bound the two nations tighter than ever, but it also created friction. For every migrant supporting their family abroad, there was a Trinbagonian family wondering why their tax dollars were stretched thin, why their hospital wait times were rising, and why their government was negotiating gas deals with a dictatorship instead of investing in citizens. Economic strain fed political division, and political division fueled public anger. Still, the leadership in Port of Spain argued that there was no alternative. The country needed foreign labor. It needed Venezuelan gas. It needed to survive. And survival, in times like these, required difficult decisions. So the economy moved forward, uneven, unbalanced, but moving, fueled by oil, sustained by migrants, strained by pressure. In Chapter 7, we arrive at the final turning point, the human cost of it all. Behind the numbers, the deals, and the politics lie real lives. In shelters, in boats, in detention centers, in classrooms, in kitchens. The final chapter will take you there, to the heart of the tension, where survival meets dignity, and where nations are tested not by policy, but by compassion. Chapter 7, Sea of Humanity, Dignity, Death, and the Question of What's Next. The waters between Venezuela and Trinidad and Tobago are not wide. But for those who cross them, the journey is life-altering. For some, it is the path to survival. For others, it ends in tragedy. And for all, migrants and citizens alike, it raises the same question. What kind of nation will Trinidad and Tobago become in the face of crisis? In a small fishing village near Icacos, villagers still speak in hushed tones about a night when a pirogue washed ashore, half-sunk, its passengers missing. The Coast Guard later confirmed that several bodies had been recovered miles off the coast. Among the dead were two women, one holding a baby wrapped in plastic. The child did not survive. These stories are not rare. Each month more boats arrive, some welcomed, some intercepted, some lost forever. Each carries people willing to risk their lives because the life behind them was already unbearable. But as the years stretch on, so too does the emotional fatigue. In shelters and temporary housing, Venezuelan families live in limbo. Many cannot legally work. Their children grow up speaking English and Spanish, unsure of where they belong. They cling to their culture while adapting to new rules, new foods, new fears. Some live openly, others hide, from authorities, from traffickers, from shame. And on the other side, Trinbagonians wrestle with their own uncertainties. The initial compassion has been tested by reality. Communities feel changed. Systems feel overwhelmed. Trust has eroded, not just between migrants and citizens, but between people and the institutions meant to guide them. In detention centers, legal advocates speak of overcrowding, unclear procedures, and emotional breakdowns. In schools, teachers improvise, juggling languages and trauma. In clinics, doctors make hard decisions with limited resources. The state does what it can, enforcing laws, negotiating deals, issuing statements. But the crisis is not just political. It is personal. It is Carla, the Venezuelan mother who fled gang violence and now teaches neighborhood children to read. It is Jason, the Trinbagonian fisherman who shares half his catch with a migrant family every Thursday. It is Sophia, a teenage girl born in Caracas, now fluent in English, who wants to become a nurse in Port of Spain, but doesn't know if she'll ever be allowed to stay. It is the quiet acts that define the character of a nation, more than any summit or sanction ever could. And yet, policy still matters. Without a formal refugee framework, thousands remain in legal limbo. Without deeper international support, Trinidad and Tobago shoulders more than its fair share. Without regional collaboration, the burden is uneven. And without empathy, the crisis risks becoming just another headline, instead of a call to action. So what's next? The truth is, no one knows. Venezuela remains unstable. Migration will not stop tomorrow. The sea will continue to carry those who have no other option, and Trinidad and Tobago will continue to face impossible choices. But amid all the tension, one thing is clear. This is not just a story of borders. It is a story of dignity. A nation is tested not by the comfort of its wealth, but by the weight of its conscience. And the question for Trinidad and Tobago is no longer whether it will be affected, but how it will respond again and again in the face of ongoing crisis. Because compassion is not a one-time act. It is a practice, a decision, a policy, a promise. And the eyes of the world are still watching, triggered economic instability. What began as a nationalist movement soon turned authoritarian, with power concentrated in the presidency, state control of industries, and the silencing of political opposition. Venezuela's economy, once one of the richest in South America, began to crumble. As basic goods became scarce and hyperinflation spiraled out of control, ordinary Venezuelans started to flee. By 2014, when Nicolás Maduro took power after Chávez's death, the situation worsened. Food shortages, blackouts, and rising violence engulfed daily life. Trinidad and Tobago, by then, had become one of the closest and most accessible destinations for escape. But as thousands began arriving, first by plane, then by boat, the mood in Port of Spain began to shift. This wasn't just a trickle of visitors anymore. It was a surge of desperation. The government of Trinidad and Tobago found itself at a crossroads. Humanitarian instincts battled with national interests. International law, including refugee protocols, urged compassion. But locals feared rising crime, job competition, and a strain on health care and housing. Meanwhile, maritime patrols struggled to keep up. In many coastal communities, boats arrived under the cover of night. Some brought women and children begging for help. Others were smuggling rings, exploiting the crisis for profit. The blurred line between refugee and infiltrator made policy nearly impossible to implement. Still, Trinidad and Tobago tried to manage the crisis with a measure of control. In 2019, the government offered a registration program, granting over 16,000 Venezuelans temporary legal status and work permits. It was a bold move for a small nation already battling its own economic pressures. But it wasn't enough. The situation kept evolving. Venezuelans who couldn't register continued arriving illegally. Accusations grew that Trinidad and Tobago was detaining migrants in poor conditions. Stories surfaced of families being separated and children being deported. One case, involving the deportation of 16 Venezuelan minors in November 2020, sparked international outrage, especially when it was revealed that the children were put in boats and sent back across dangerous waters without due process. The decision was later reversed, but the damage to the country's international image had already been done. Behind the scenes, the politics grew thornier. Trinidad and Tobago had long maintained a quiet but firm relationship with the Venezuelan government. In the face of U.S. sanctions on Venezuela's oil sector, Trinidad and Tobago negotiated bilateral agreements directly with Maduro's administration, particularly around energy partnerships involving natural gas. Critics accused Trinidad and Tobago of turning a blind eye to Venezuela's human rights abuses in exchange for economic advantage. But officials in Port of Spain defended their actions. They argued that geography and shared resources made cooperation a necessity, not a choice. They weren't endorsing Maduro. They were ensuring their own country's survival. That tension, the fine line between diplomacy and complicity, defines much of the strain today. At the heart of it all lies the water. The Gulf of Paria, once a connector of cultures, has become a passage of peril. It is now a stage where desperation meets sovereignty, and where international law is tested against real-world limits. As we dive deeper into this story, we will explore how this humanitarian and political crisis unfolds, and what it reveals about the fragility of small nations caught in the wake of global collapse. Chapter 2. The Migration Wave. Hope in Small Boats, Fear on the Shore. In the pre-dawn silence off the southwestern coast of Trinidad, villagers in Cedros often wake to an eerie hum. Not from their own fishing boats, but from long, narrow Venezuelan pirogues arriving under cover of darkness, their outboard motors muffled, passengers hidden beneath plastic tarps. Some carry children curled in their mother's arms, faces hollow from hunger. Others hold nothing but a name and a folded photograph. They are not tourists. They are survivors. Since the collapse of Venezuela's economy, over 7.7 million people have fled the country, one of the largest refugee crises in modern history. While most head to Colombia or Brazil, thousands make the shorter, more dangerous crossing to Trinidad and Tobago, lured by proximity and the hope of work. The journey across the Gulf of Paria is treacherous. Smugglers charge desperate families thousands of U.S. dollars to board unlicensed vessels. Passengers are packed shoulder to shoulder, sometimes forced to crouch under tarps to avoid detection. Coast Guard patrols try to intercept illegal landings, but the sheer number of boats and the shifting nature of routes make full surveillance impossible. Worse still, the waters are unforgiving. Dozens have drowned. Some vanish without a trace, their last calls echoing through WhatsApp voice notes to family in Port of Spain. Parents send children ahead, hoping for asylum or shelter. Many never reunite. Inside Trinidad and Tobago, the response has been mixed. A blend of generosity and fear, compassion and resistance. On one hand, ordinary Trinbagonians have stepped up in remarkable ways. Church groups collect donations. Teachers work overtime in crowded classrooms to include Spanish-speaking children. Volunteers translate legal documents and help file refugee claims. But on the other hand, xenophobia grows. In working-class neighborhoods, local fishermen complain that Venezuelans are undercutting their prices. Small shop owners allege rising petty theft. Healthcare workers report overwhelmed clinics and long waiting times. The government walks a tightrope. Officials insist they are not anti-immigrant. They simply need order. National Security Minister Fitzgerald Hines has publicly stated that while Trinidad and Tobago is not a signatory to the 1951 UN Refugee Convention, the country still acts with humanity. Yet critics say policies tell a different story. After the 2019 registration exercise that granted temporary permits to roughly 16,000 Venezuelans, no long-term refugee framework was implemented. Many of those permits have since expired, leaving thousands in legal limbo. The result? A shadow economy of undocumented workers, vulnerable to abuse, exploitation, and silence. Women are hit the hardest. In several cases, young Venezuelan women have reported being lured into sex work under false promises of waitressing jobs. Human traffickers use the crisis as cover, preying on those who fear deportation too much to report abuse. In some cases, brothels operate openly in rural areas, shielded by silence or corruption. In 2021, an investigation by Trinidad and Tobago's counter-trafficking unit led to several arrests and the rescue of dozens of victims. But law enforcement admits the true numbers are likely much higher. Yet amid the chaos, moments of humanity shine through. In a community center outside San Fernando, a young Venezuelan mother named Carla teaches Spanish to Trinidadian children in exchange for food. She fled with her two sons after her husband was killed by armed gangs in Maracaibo. "I thought we would die at sea," she whispers, eyes wet. "But I had to try. I had to try for them." Carla's story is one of thousands. Her journey from fear to fragile safety captures the emotional weight of this crisis better than any policy paper. But she lives in uncertainty. No legal status, no guarantee of protection, and no idea what comes next. For Trinidad and Tobago, the challenge is not only legal or logistical. It is moral. How does a small island nation, just over 1.3 million people, manage an influx of trauma and desperation while preserving its own stability? How does it uphold dignity when systems are strained to the breaking point? The answer remains unclear. And so the boats keep coming, one after another. Each one carries a new story. Each one pushes the line between what a country can do and what it must do. In the next chapter, we'll explore how energy politics, specifically natural gas deals, complicate this humanitarian crisis even further. Because behind every public statement, there is a pipeline. And every pipeline has a price. Chapter 3. Energy, Sanctions, and Silent Alliances. If the migration crisis is the most visible layer of tension between Venezuela and Trinidad and Tobago, the energy deals beneath the surface reveal a quieter, more politically delicate dimension. one where survival meets strategy and diplomacy dances with controversy. Trinidad and Tobago is the Caribbean's largest producer of natural gas. Its liquefied natural gas, LNG, industry fuels much of its economy, with exports flowing to markets as far as Europe and Asia. But in recent years, output has declined. Gas fields are aging, and the country has scrambled to secure new sources to keep its plants running and its economy stable. Just across the water, Venezuela holds one of the world's largest proven reserves of natural gas. Untapped, underused, and sanctioned. Herein lies the contradiction. Since 2019, the United States imposed harsh sanctions on Venezuela's energy sector to punish Nicolas Maduro's government for alleged election fraud and human rights abuses. These sanctions bar American companies, and by extension, most of their partners, from engaging with Venezuela's state-owned oil and gas firms like PDVSA. But Trinidad and Tobago has been negotiating a different path. In a series of quiet back-channel talks, Trinidad and Tobago pursued energy agreements with Caracas, most notably the Dragon Gas Field deal. Located in Venezuelan waters near the maritime border, the Dragon Field contains an estimated 4.2 trillion cubic feet of gas. Accessing that gas could help restart Trinidad and Tobago's underused LNG facilities and petrochemical plants, but doing so meant working with Venezuela and navigating a minefield of international law. The government of Trinidad and Tobago argued it had no choice. In 2023, Prime Minister Dr. Keith Rowley announced that the U.S. Treasury had granted a rare license, allowing Trinidad and Tobago to work with Venezuela's state-owned energy firm to develop the Dragon Field, as long as no payments went directly to the Maduro regime in cash. Instead, the U.S. mandated that any proceeds be used to support humanitarian efforts within Venezuela, such as health and education. It was a diplomatic breakthrough and a political gamble. Supporters hailed it as a win for regional cooperation and economic survival. After all, why should Trinidad and Tobago suffer energy shortages when gas lies just 7 miles away? And if those gas sales could support Venezuelan civilians without empowering Maduro, wasn't that a just compromise? But critics saw it differently. Human rights groups accused Trinidad and Tobago of legitimizing a regime responsible for documented atrocities, including torture, repression, and corruption. Opposition voices in Venezuela and abroad warned that deals like Dragon provided lifelines to dictators. Even in Washington, voices within Congress questioned whether humanitarian oversight of the funds would be enforceable or just symbolic. For Trinidad and Tobago, it became a matter of sovereignty. Why should a sovereign nation be told how to engage with its neighbors, especially in matters of critical infrastructure? Was it fair to expect a small island economy to bear the brunt of international sanctions designed by global powers? These questions weren't just theoretical. They played out in press conferences, energy summits, and secretive diplomatic meetings. But beneath the headlines, one truth remained clear. Trinidad and Tobago needed gas. Venezuela had it, and both sides knew the stakes. Meanwhile, citizens of Trinidad and Tobago watched with mixed emotions. Some hoped the deal would bring jobs, revive plants in Point Lisas, and stabilize the economy. Others feared deeper entanglement with a crumbling regime and the backlash it could bring. What if the U.S. license was revoked? What if international partners pulled away? On the ground, whispers grew that Trinidad and Tobago had become a quiet ally of Maduro. In 2020, a controversial visit by Venezuelan Vice President Delcy Rodriguez to Trinidad sparked outrage, particularly when opposition leaders in Venezuela accused Trinidad and Tobago of aiding Maduro in bypassing international isolation. The government dismissed the claims. They insisted the visit was purely diplomatic and that Trinidad and Tobago remained neutral, focused on economic survival and regional cooperation, not politics. But perception is powerful, And in the complex web of regional geopolitics, perception often outweighs fact. So while boats continued to arrive under the stars, carrying desperate migrants from Venezuela, pipelines beneath the sea were being planned to carry something else entirely. Hope, strategy, and quiet desperation from Trinidad and Tobago back to the source. And just like that, the same sea that brought the suffering now offered salvation. But for whom? In the next chapter, we'll examine the international response to this tangled crisis. How has the world, from the United Nations to the United States, reacted to Trinidad and Tobago's choices? And what happens when global pressure meets the sovereignty of a small but strategic island? Because in the game of nations, even the smallest players carry weight when standing on oil and gas. Chapter 4. Pressure from the Outside. Global Eyes on the Caribbean Front Line. To the average observer, Trinidad and Tobago may seem like a quiet island paradise, famous for carnival, calypso, and oil. But in the corridors of international diplomacy, it has become something far more complicated, a geopolitical crossroads. And in recent years, it has come under increasing pressure from powerful players who expect this small nation to choose sides in a crisis not of its own making. From the moment Venezuelans began fleeing en masse, the eyes of the world turned to every country receiving them, especially those as close as Trinidad and Tobago. Human rights organizations, foreign embassies, and major powers like the United States began to scrutinize how the island nation responded. The results were polarizing. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, and other humanitarian bodies have long advocated for a more structured refugee framework in Trinidad and Tobago. While the country has signed certain international protocols, it is not a party to the 1951 Refugee Convention, a key legal tool in defining and protecting the rights of asylum seekers. That technicality gave the government room to maneuver and sparked criticism. Reports of harsh detention conditions, deportations without due process, and children sent back to danger triggered outcry. Perhaps no moment captured global attention more than the 2020 deportation of 16 Venezuelan children and their families. They were placed in boats and sent back toward Venezuela, alone, across the same treacherous waters so many had risked their lives to cross. The decision was later reversed after intense backlash, but the incident sparked a wave of condemnation. International media outlets, human rights groups, and even celebrities drew attention to what many called an unforgivable breach of basic humanitarian principle. Trinidad and Tobago's government stood firm. Then Prime Minister Dr. Keith Rowley dismissed the critics, stating bluntly that Trinidad and Tobago is not a refugee camp. He argued that larger nations, with far more resources, had done far less to help Venezuelans. His point was clear: the international community had no right to criticize without offering meaningful support. This became a recurring theme in the island's defense. Officials insisted that their country had accepted tens of thousands of migrants, launched registration programs, and maintained order under incredible pressure, all without the financial support or infrastructure available to richer nations. Yet the pressure only grew. In Washington, lawmakers began linking Trinidad and Tobago's energy deals with Venezuela to broader questions of regional loyalty. Was the island supporting democracy or enabling dictatorship? Should U.S. licenses for gas deals be reevaluated? Could sanctions be applied if Trinidad and Tobago was seen as a loophole for Maduro's survival? Behind the scenes, diplomats worked feverishly to calm tensions. Port of Spain maintained that its deals were lawful, humanitarian in intent, and essential for domestic energy stability. But they knew they were treading a thin line, one that could snap with the change of an administration in Washington or a shift in Venezuela's chaotic politics. Meanwhile, advocacy groups began tracking every migrant story coming out of Trinidad and Tobago. The media spotlight brought heat, but it also brought attention to the island's precarious position. local NGOs pushed for more humane treatment, clearer legal protections, and increased collaboration with international agencies. But the island's resources were finite. Border patrol officers were overworked. Courts were backed up with asylum-related cases. Schools and hospitals saw rising demand, but no rise in funding. The social fabric began to fray. And yet, amid all this, the people of Trinidad and Tobago showed a resilience that defied politics. In fishing villages and urban communities, residents continued to offer food, shelter, and jobs to their Venezuelan neighbors. Teachers made space in their classrooms. Doctors treated undocumented patients. Landlords, even amid economic strain, gave struggling families a place to sleep. They did this not because of international pressure, but because of Caribbean identity, shared roots, shared pain, a sense that, even across borders, people are still people. Still, the question loomed large. How long could this balancing act last? As global institutions watched and judged, Trinidad and Tobago walked a path that few others dared to tread, between diplomacy and defiance, between aid and enforcement. It was a reminder that small countries do not